there's so much that we need to share. So send a smile and show you care.
Hello, good afternoon, everybody. This is James Martinez with another edition of Cashflow. And boy, do we have a lot of stuff to cover today after a week of events and so forth. And I've got some personal news I'm going to bring up to you as well. Living proof that in a world of living in a digital environment with banking and identity theft and so forth, I just managed to crack one of the biggest identity theft cases I think I've ever run across. It's the most complicated in the world. And I'm, as you know, when I've spoken with Bob Nevert here, we've talked about the ability to how are the banks going to be able to control identity theft? How easy is it to do? And what can you do when you're living with computers, texting information back and forth, using people's pictures, posing as somebody else, what that can do? And I can tell you right now, based on experience, that I can name, and I won't do so here for their own anonymity, but probably 15 people in the United States that I have heard about or spoken about in the last week, their lives are completely, totally destroyed for something completely false identity theft. And if I were to sum up what the nature and future of that would be and how it would be controlled, I have no idea, because if a person who I know could pull this off over an extended period of time for 4 or 5 years and extort hundreds of thousands of dollars of people all over the United States, God only knows what you can do if you're really serious with credit cards or banking or anything like that. So everything that Marty Kaiser has said, Bob Nevert has said, I have said, and I've said over years and years ago, that this is what's happening. This is where we're going, and this is what computers are doing. So that, as well as the latest news, I wanted to get Bob's commentary on that, as last week's issues with issues on Wall Street. So without further ado, we're going to go ahead and get started with Bob Nevert. Bob, are you there?
Yes, good afternoon, James.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you doing?
Great, and congratulations on what you're cracking. You told me a bit about it last night, and it's pretty big, and good work on your part. Very good.
Oh, what's the interesting part is, Bob, that when I went and told the authorities about this, they wouldn't comment on how much this is going on in the U.S. here. They wouldn't even get into the details. And I know for a fact that they're absolutely overwhelmed with this type of stuff, not only with the banking stuff, but with other just identity theft in general. So what does that mean now? If when you live in a digital environment and this is the capability and this is where we're at with technology now, what does that mean for the future? I mean, how can one protect oneself when technology keeps going more and more and more and people can do this?
Realize you don't have a self to protect. And then develop a new form of identity formation, which is what I'm offering with the four-body model. Using that at least so your subvocal mind, your subverbal mind, can talk to itself rather coherently, then you might remain stable. But overall, the nature of this time is endless change. And the change never can be determined as completed or dropping completely the past. So actually, there is no change on a certain level. But the change is happening, appears to be happening to those who have an identity. Okay, I want to go into this in detail. That's just a headline.
Right.
I want to lay out four phases here. In the 19th century, what was called in American culture the robber barons monopolized the economy by 1900. And there was the Antitrust Act in about 1891 or so, okay, a few years before that. But maneuvers were made to bypass that control by the U.S. Congress. But there was a lot of people around the world who had hooked into historical money, were part of the passing on and inheritance of it, who had incredible amounts and made the Rockefellers look like farmers or dirt farmers or ditch diggers.
Right.
Okay, so the Rockefellers become the icon of the American century, but there was a historical money structure from the 18th and 19th century we can call the oligarchy. And the oligarchy is sitting on the side, excuse me, is sitting on the sidelines in the 20th century as the focus is centered around Wall Street after World War I, then particularly after World War II. But the oligarchy is investing. They're not lending money to people. They're investing in companies, the mass media age, the wealth for the common man, the technological abundance of the 20th century. They're investing in key parts of that. So their money is expanding and inflating or accumulating so that it's not unusual that by the 1980s, some of these people could be trillionaires. But mm-hmm. it's off the books because if you bring their money into the mainstream Wall Street market, it screws up the M1 supply, the money supply. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But you have this oligarchy sitting on the sidelines through the 20th century. Meanwhile, the telegraph, telephone, radio, automobiles, gramophone, all that electric technology comes in 100 years ago. And that is actually software wealth, not mm-hmm. hardware wealth. Everybody's sharing in the information environment. They're able to move their chemical body through the telephone all over the planet. Now, how do we measure that? Well, it became a problem for the American bankers, Morgan and Rockefeller, so they set up the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve was a private bank representing private ownership, the alphabetic printed entity we've talked about before,
but it
was in a problem because you couldn't even claim that you were wealthy by 1913 if everybody was engaging in the software communism or the software environments of free information, relatively free once you had electric gadgets, okay?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So the Federal Reserve locked down the right to private identity by being a private bank with a government name, Federal Reserve, and they preserved the role of money, and that money now was moving into public property. It wasn't going to be completely that till the 30s, but the fact that people had to start paying income tax, which was against the Constitution, and all this maneuvers by the Federal Reserve and the gang that did that in 1913, they had to do that because money now was no longer something that completely was the constituent structure of the economy, the thing that everybody needed as they did in the 19th century. Now it's starting to become necessary to accumulate it rapidly and accumulate a lot of cash, and we call that, and that's through taxation. So the Federal Reserve had to bypass the Constitution based on the printing press and move into a new role for the printing press. Mm-hmm. Now, the 20s, with radio and airplanes and that, inflated that, so it collapsed. All right. Then you have the U.S. Treasury. Now, the U.S. Treasury, I'll make that the fourth part. The third part is, because of the collapse of the economy in 1929, 31, 33, mm-hmm. there were all kinds of options at the table. People could start using local currency if they wanted to, or if they imagined they could. But the idea of working for human scale for local communities was impossible if the local communities were scattered through the electric space. And so it was a global village, and everybody really wasn't located where they thought they were in Massachusetts or Washington State or Oregon or Nevada. They were discarnate under these electric conditions. Which area the Federal Reserve had already adapted to, okay?
Right.
So it's important to understand the Federal Reserve is a private banking consortium that represents interface with the community, with the government of the United States. It maintains its role as a private banking situation because it must represent the literate private identity.
Mm-hmm.
So the role of the Federal Reserve was to make money a medium for everybody to share through income tax, but at the same time it had to be run by private ownership. Okay, so that's the phase from, let's say, 1900 to 1918.
Right.
From 1918 to 1945, you have the reinforcement of the American sense of community and patriotism and eventually everybody getting guaranteed some money. Now, the fourth part is the U.S. Treasury. The U.S. Treasury represents the government, But it had to acknowledge in the early part of the 20th century that the printed identity or visual space had to be preserved by a private banking industry in companion or complementary relationship with the U.S. Treasury representing the community, the larger community of the United States. Now, once we move into the 1945-1960 period, the growth of digital technology and the extreme level of electronic earlier technology, the U.S. Treasury ends up being owned, quote, owned by Japan and China and all and Britain and all kinds of people who prop up the idea of the financial globalized economy, with the United States representing the tribal identity. It's the United States that is the strongest part of the world and the backing of the American dollar, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So what I've laid out here is you've got the oligarchic money of the 19th century, which is sitting on the sidelines through the 20th century. Because money is vulnerable, it can only increase and inflate because it cannot measure. Money cannot measure the discarnate state.
Let's go back. Money, you've got to explain that, because I guarantee you 99.9% of the people listening don't understand what you mean by that. So go ahead and explain money and the discarnate state.
If I can use this telephone and everybody else can use the telephone and it costs me 10 cents or a nickel, as it used to be, the payphone, then it's relatively free compared to the cost of land or an automobile or any hardware technology. So the relative free use of that environment cannot be measured, and you don't charge people 10 bucks every time they use a telephone.
Right, right.
So in relation to being charged for things, it's relatively free. So that comes in 100 years ago, and then radio comes in. We have to see that the discarnate electronic effect on the old measurement of quantity and value is ineffectual. The discarnate state is a kind of free environment that we all swim in, and nobody can charge for it. Now, it later gets charged with pay TV in that, you know, 80 years later. But that's the result of the digital economy. Anyways, the point is the oligarchic people have their money, and it's subject to the discarnate electric effect, too. So it increases in value, but it cannot be related to the community standards of the M1 money supply.
Mm-hmm.
About how much money is in circulation. So the rigid control of the money supply is the government control of visual space and the old medium of money. Now, the first attempt to organize that was the Federal Reserve. The second attempt was the U.S. Treasury, as the American century dominates after World War II, and the American technology involves every culture and nation in the world. It implodes into a global village, and that's when, through daily trading, eventually other countries own a big chunk of the U.S. Treasury.
Right.
Now, that confuses people. That confuses people about where we are. How can they, this other country, own our treasury? But people still think they're living in the 19th century with literate boundaries and maps and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I've laid out the oligarchic situation, historical legacy, the Federal Reserve, which is a response to the beginning of the electric environment 100 years ago, almost 100 years ago. Then you have people who wish there was local community and would develop, regain control of the Congress, you know, like the Ron Paul movement, ban the Federal Reserve, ban income tax, and get back to the literate Constitution for the sake of the United States and local community of the citizens of the United States in relation to the rest of the world. Now, that's been a pretty futile gesture because the electronic and digital economies bypassed that, and they determine the structure we live in. The fourth level, so that's the local, the movement towards local preservation of community, and the fourth level is the U.S. Treasury, which I'm saying is the most modern situation. It's the actual control point and fulcrum of ecology in relation to global currencies interacting 24/7. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. So now we have the press conference on last Friday. What was it? September 15th, I think?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
18th. No, maybe it's not. What was Friday? What's today? Today is the 19th. Okay. On September Friday the 19th, you had standing before the Global Theater, which, as I've explained in previous shows, is very fragile and hard to perceive accurately, but you had four people standing there saying that we need to define the word that makes the market. We're going to define.
Are you referring to the four people, Bush, Treasury Secretary Paulson, when they stood before the White House image? Are you talking about that?
Yes. You had Bernanke, Ben Bernanke, the Federal Reserve Chief. You had the
Paulson.
Securities and Exchange Commissioner, Cox. Mm-hmm. You had Secretary of Treasury Paulson, and you had George Bush.
Right.
President Bush. Okay, these four guys represent the four phases. Federal Reserve, the early result of the electric environment of the early 20th century, Ben Bernanke. The U.S. Treasury, represented by ex-Goldman Sachs leader, CEO, Henry Paulson. He represents the chip landscape, and he's a big... He was a very important person in the derivatives world, okay, in the hedge fund world through Goldman Sachs. Then you have the representative of community or national values or protecting citizens, et cetera. That's the Securities and Exchange Commission. They're the local cop, right?
Right, exactly.
Then you have President George Bush. I've only left out, so at this point, the oligarchy. Does President Bush represent the oligarchy?
I don't think President Bush represents anything or anybody.
Yeah, good point. But he does, if you read up the history, there's many people on the Internet saying that the Bush family is related to the royal family.
Right, exactly.
And because they interfaced, their family interfaced with the global situation before World War II, they're accused of working with the Nazis before and after the war and all that. I would say the history of the Bush family through his grandfather, Prescott Bush, and the Heron brothers, is the interface with the oligarchic money.
Right.
All right? And a lot
yes.
of Chris Story's work on worldreports.org exposes the Bush, or Senior Bush, George Bush, as the head of the DVD Dachau and the Nazi Combine, which would not necessarily link into oligarchic money, but Chris Story does see it, the Bush family interfacing with the off-the-books, offshore movement of money. Now, the oligarchy was brought back in the early 80s under Prince Charles, and they propped up the economy after the collapse of Rockefeller in the late 70s, the collapse of the national economy and even the global economy.
Right.
So then you had junk bonds and then Internet stocks and then the subprime crisis. And the junk bonds got entangled with the SNL crisis, right? So
right.
three crises have been the SNL crisis, the Internet dot-com crisis, and then the mortgage crisis. All of that is the use of the oligarchic money since the early 80s to prop up a collapsed electronic money.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone looks at the books, they would say the Federal Reserve is bankrupt, U.S. Treasury is bankrupt. What they don't know is the oligarchy is bankrupt right now. And then the community, what Cox protects, is in trouble. So you have these four levels of panic and four figures standing there. And we know, as I've explained in previous shows, that this economy is not based on money, value, or even derivatives. It is based on typing. As long as people are typing and you and I are talking on the radio and everybody else is talking on the media, then the economy can keep moving.
Right.
But it doesn't move forward. It just oscillates up and down.
Right, yes.
You know, it's some people call it dead cat bouncing, but it's really not a dead cat. It's a living cat if we understand the technologies come alive. Because if something moves, humans generally consider it organic and alive. So if the ticker's going up and down, then it's alive. All right?
Right.
So
okay.
we have a living economy. And the typing is organized by what the White House says. And the White House organized the four historical factors, the oligarchy, the Federal Reserve, the U.S. Treasury, and the community part represented by Cox. And those four components made up the word that made the market, which was on September 19th, we're going to put $700 billion into the economy, and we're going to own it, and we're nationalized.
Right.
Now...
Okay. Wait. Before we get started, are you gonna give your commentary on what that's going to do, if anything?
Yes.
Okay.
Now I'm gonna having laid out the four structures, the four historical factors, oligarchic money, which was on the sidelines, the electronic money represented by the Federal Reserve, but emphasizing private ownership and private identity, which is the legacy of the West. I own something and you don't, right?
Right, exactly.
And then there's the U.S. Treasury, which represents the global economy, interfacing the American M1 money supply with every other country's M1 supply. And then you have the idea that we are human beings and we have a community and we should be preserving the future for our children. That's the police function of Chairman Cox. All right?
Right. Okay.
All right. So here's this article, very good article for bouncing off of. It's by Ellen Brown. And it's called The Web of Debt. And she begins the article with the title, "It's the Derivative, Stupid. Why Fannie, Freddie, and the American Insurance International Group, American International Group of Hank Greenberg, all had to be bailed out." She wrote this September 18th. So with what I said in mind, listen to this. Something extraordinary is going on with these government bailouts. In March 2008, the Federal Reserve extended a $55 billion loan to J.P. Morgan. So there's the Rockefeller gang, J.P. Morgan Chase. The Federal Reserve had to extend the print money for them to rescue investment bank Bear Stearns from bankruptcy, a highly controversial move that tested the limits of the Federal Reserve Act. On September 7, 2008, the U.S. government seized private mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and imposed a conservatorship, a form of bankruptcy. But rather than let the bankruptcy court sort out the assets among the claimants, the Treasury extended an unlimited credit line to the insolvent corporations and said it would exercise its authority to buy their stock, effectively nationalizing them. Now, note, she says the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which were original government institutions, then were privatized in the digital era, say 1970s to 1990s, and now are going to be renationalized, so to speak. Okay. Brought back to the original government category. Now, this person writes on September 18th, the Federal Reserve has announced it is giving an $85 billion loan to American International Group, the world's largest insurance company, in exchange for nearly 80% stake in the insurer. So she asked, the Fed is buying an insurance company? Now, do you see the questions begin on the defining and Ellen Brown's attempt to understand where she is in relation to these environmental movements? Okay?
Right.
So she's thinking the Fed is, well, as you'll see, the Fed is buying an insurance company. Where exactly is that covered in the Federal Reserve Act? Okay, so she's citing printed space. The Constitution says the Fed can't do, doesn't say it does that. Right. The Associated Press calls it a government takeover. But this is not your ordinary nationalization like the purchase of Fannie Freddie stock by the U.S. Treasury. The Federal Reserve has the power to print the national money supply, but it is not actually part of the U.S. government. Okay,
exactly.
Good point. She says it is a private banking corporation owned by a consortium of private banks. So why are we calling the takeover of this government takeover by a private bank a government takeover? She says the banking industry just bought the world's largest insurance company, and they use federal money to do it.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so there's a contradiction. If you're a literate person who says, I live here, and the capital is in Washington, and that institution is here, and the Federal Reserve is over there, and what is my visual relationship? You're using your eye to read your position on the map.
Okay, now, wait a second. I want you to hold it right there, because I want you to summarize this particular article and what's going to be happening next, because I think everybody, including me, is completely confused when they've done that and what that means and what's going to come next. And it was all over the press and all over LA radio, like, how can they do this and so forth. So let's take a break. We'll be back right after this. This is James Martinez with Cash Flow. Special guest today is Bob Nevert. Stick around, everybody. We'll be right back after these messages. Stand by, everybody. Hey everybody, this is James Martinez from the Cash Flow Show. I want to ask you one question and one question only. You're ready to change your life. Now, as you begin to think about that question, how many of you are swimming in credit card debt
tired of your credit cards controlling your life, behind on your payments, struggling to make ends meet, worried about your financial well-being? You're going to end that now. Enough is enough. This is hot. Are you ready to feel good? Now? That's right. Call our 800 number and listen to the 12-minute overview. It explains who we are and what we do to end your credit card debt. Leave your name and number after the message and do it today. Call 888-213-7655. That's 888-213-7655. Freedom is a phone call away. Away. A way for you to feel good now. 888-213-7655. 888-213-7655.
In her ebook and audiobooks, Sacred Journey, Sacred Life, author and respected women's health authority, Reva Dawa, takes the hand of Ellen Stein, whose discovery of breast cancer propels her down a new, albeit scary, path of enlightenment. Written to address the alarming, isolating feelings that women with cancer often have, Sacred Journey, Sacred Life is the essential go-to guide for those seeking a blend of modern and ancient medical practices. This beautiful work is available as an ebook or 6-CD audiobook from Amazon.com or at sacred-journey-books.com. That's sacred-journey-books.com.
Your intentional life is making every day a new adventure. Join me, Annette Peterson, as we explore topics relevant to personal and professional improvement, such as health, finance, self-esteem, and sometimes just plain fun. Saturdays at 2 p.m. here on AchieveRadio.com. Oh, and make sure to check out the archives so that you don't miss a thing.
This is Sarah Lynn, and you're listening to AchieveRadio.com.
If you're the joke of the neighborhood, why should you care if you're feeling good? Well, take the long way home. Take the long way home. There are times that you feel you're part of the scenery.
James Martinez with Cashflow. It's September 24th, 2008. Anybody, if you're out there and you have specific questions for Bob Nevert, please feel free to call in. The number is 888-235-7342. Again, it's 888-235-7342. So go ahead, Bob. I want to go ahead and make sure we get all this encapsulated in this hour. So go ahead where you were before.
Okay, so you had these four figures standing there, Bush, Cox, Bernanke, and Paulson, representing four historical phases of the 20th century in the American empire.
Mm-hmm.
But they are holding a press conference from the White House, which is the only thing that determines reality. So the four functions are inside the word that makes the market, and the word is in English. Okay. We have to look at each one of these functions, four functions, are interfacing, replaceable, and one can be, the U.S. Treasury can be the Federal Reserve can be the oligarch money, and the oligarch money can be your local community. Yes, as
right.
They brought in Prince Charles to prop up the global economy for the global community. So we're looking at the merger of these four, but watch how the literate mind, the informed, educated mind, looks at these four parts as separate functions. So Alan Brown says the banking industry just bought the world's largest insurance company, and they use federal money to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, the Treasury is setting up a temporary financing program at the Fed's request. The program will auction Treasury bills to raise cash for the Fed's use. The initiative aims to help the Fed manage its balance sheet following its efforts to enhance its liquidity facilities over the previous few quarters. You'll see there's two things pretending they're helping each other, but they're the same thing if you look at what's being said here. So she says, Treasury bills are the IOUs of the federal government. We, the taxpayers, are on the hook for the Fed's enhanced liquidity facilities, meaning the loans it has been making to everyone in sight, bank or non-bank, exercising obscure provisions in the Federal Reserve Act that may or may not say they can do it. What's going on here? Why not let the free market work? Now, is there a free market? No. It's a programmed environment. It's a satellite.
Is there a free market? That's a big question. Go on.
Yeah, but there is a free market when you have a computer. and you can engage in Wall Street day trades. You can type. It's a freedom to type. There's a free zone for typing. It's the whole world. It's not a market. Not a hardware market. It's a software communication market. Mm-hmm. Bankruptcy courts know how to sort out assets and reorganize companies so they can operate again. Why the extraordinary measures for Fannie, Freddie, and AIG? Then she says the answer may have less to do with saving the insurance business, the housing market, or the Chinese investors clamoring for a bailout than with the greatest Ponzi scheme in history, one that is holding up the entire global banking system. What had to be saved at all costs was not housing or the dollar, but the financial derivatives industry. And the precipice from which it had to be saved was an event of default, in quotes, event of default that could have collapsed a quadrillion-dollar derivatives bubble, a collapse that could take the entire global banking system down with it. So she's going to emphasize that the whole issue is derivatives. And what are derivatives? That is actually the digital environment that computers brought in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's call it the Internet. The economy based on the Internet since the 80s is something that she's calling derivatives. But when you read her analysis of derivatives in terms of visual categories and money being speculated on, she misses the point about it's not derivatives, it's the environment. And what's the environment? It's typing, okay? Typing and interfacing.
Okay. All right.
So I'm going to say it's not derivatives, it's typing. But watch how she gets herself in problems here if you call it derivatives, which is an attempt to make it involve and relate to money and cash being exchanged. Now, under the Federal Reserve era, and the mid-20th century, we lived at the speed of light. But once the digital economy came in, we lived at the speed of thought. Another word for thought is speculation. Right now, you and I are in the speculative environment, speculating on what's going on. Okay?
Exactly, right. Right.
All right. So she says, until recently, most people never even heard of derivatives. I would say most people had never noticed the effects of the chip landscape, of the chip environment, of digital technology, right?
Mm-hmm.
She says, but in terms of money traded, these investments represent the biggest financial market in the world. Well, the thing is you cannot measure when everybody's typing. You can't keep the accounting books on, well, who's making money and who's losing it, okay? But so,
right.
But she thinks it's huge. She thinks this is a quadrillion-dollar industry.
Uh-huh.
So, and according to the visual space literate person, it is. But she says, this big financial market, derivatives are financial instruments that have no intrinsic value but derive their value from something else. Now, the something else is the fact that you're typing to somebody and they're typing back. The
mm-hmm.
transaction is the value.
Okay.
And she's, basically, they're just bets, which means speculation. I think it's going to go this way.
Or I think it's going to go that way. Right, okay.
Yeah. She says you can hedge your bet that something you own will go up by placing a side bet that it will go down. Now, you see, going up and going down are visual coordinates which don't really explain or describe the digital environment where everybody's in the same pace, same place, touching each other through typing. Can't make a distinction between each of us.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's just tactile. It's the fingers going.
Okay, but what you just said in the last 1 minute, I think, is the big chunk of information. I just got my hair stood on end there about what you just said there. So do back and explain that part just a second.
All right.
About
well,
the seesawing back and forth.
Yeah, I'll use what she writes to repeat that. So
okay. We're
talking about betting, which is speculation, which is thinking. And when you're typing, you're thinking. And you can't
mm-hmm.
tell where your thought leaves off and another person's thought comes in. When you read it, it looks like someone else thought it. But you'll see that thought is very intimate, and we live very intimately with our chip technology. And
yes.
So we are – one aspect of thought is that if I think one thing, then it's not another. So the essential doubleness of me being me and you not being me, but you being you, even though we are thinking in the same language and thinking about the same environment, it appears we're different. So we can make a split. We can say that
I can't wait till people listen to these archives because it's just going to have to sit down and listen to it over and over again. All right, continue.
I apologize that this might require a little thought.
Yes,
you know,
of course.
You know, but I agree that us taking time to spell this out is totally irrelevant to the movement of this situation we're in, right? This is
mm-hmm.
the irony of it. We help keep the economy going by talking.
Mm-hmm.
Even though talking is nowhere near what people are experiencing when they live at the speed of thought. So she says you can hedge your bet that something you own will go up by placing a side bet that will go down. Now, one of the things about tactility is you're going in all directions at the same time because you can't visualize tactility. You're always in touch, which means the economy won't crash and it won't succeed. Back to the point here. Hedge funds hedge bets in the derivatives market. Bets can be placed on anything from the price of tea in China to the movements of specific markets. Then there's the big authority, Robert Chapman, an economist. He wrote a decade ago, the point everyone misses is that buying derivatives is not investing. It is gambling, insurance, and high-stakes bookmaking. Derivatives create nothing. No, it's none of those. It's just thinking. It's speculation. All right?
The speculation market, right.
Right now, on what Oprah Winfrey might be on right now, she's speculating with people about whatever the issue is today. They're thinking, and everybody's involved. Everybody thinks their little chemical body thinking their thoughts in relation to another, but when it's all broadcast, it all merges into an icon, Oprah Winfrey. That is the level of the Federal Reserve, an icon preserving private identity. So the derivatives, he says, Alan Brown, elaborating on Chapman, says, they not only create nothing, but they serve to enrich non-producers at the expense of the people who do create real goods and services. Now, that's wrong. There's nobody. This is a post-industrial society here in the United States. There are people working in some hardware plants, like a McDonald's burger place or something, and making some hardware automobiles and that. But the problem is that most people are living in the realm of speculation, where there is no production of hardware, just constant communication. And that is wealth. Okay.
Right. The interplay of communication and speculation at the same time. So everybody's wondering what's happening from one moment to the next and deciding, oh, this might be worth something, sell this, buy this. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, that makes wealth. The very worry and thinking about where things are, what time is it, and where are we going, all right?
Right.
That's what makes wealth. And everybody is participating in that, just people listening. They should be, in a way, paid to keep listening to Oprah because they're part of the economy, and they are paid because they're guaranteed a basic welfare unit, right? I mean, they supposedly can't become completely poor because Social Security will look after you. They not only create nothing, but they serve to enrich non-producers at the expense of people who do create real goods and services. So I'm showing how this kind of thinking, which a lot of people are doing, is totally irrelevant. She says, in congressional hearings in the early 1990s, derivatives trading was challenged as being an illegal form of gambling. Now, you can't stop the chip landscape. You can challenge all you want. You can, you know, have laws and ban the chip computer in the United States, but the rest of the world will continue using it, and they would rule as a larger environment. So that's why she says the practice of derivatives trading was legitimized by Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan, who not only lent legal and regulatory support to the trade, but actually promoted derivatives as a way to improve risk management. Now, the point is that he couldn't do anything else. Once you have a chip environment, computerized digital economy, you have to live with it. That's the law. That's the weather. That's the climate. That's the storm you're in. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So, okay, Greenspan doesn't have any power. He just represents the chemical body and the thinker, and the buck stops here in an environment where there is no buck, but there's incredible wealth to the point we have a quadrillion dollar worth of money based on thinking and typing. Partly, this was to boost the flagging profits of the banks. Now, the reason the flagging profits of the banks had happened is that to the degree that banks rely on the concept of money and visual space and accounting books, they're irrelevant. So the banks could not survive starting in the mid-70s once there was a digital environment starting to be built, right?
Right.
And so to keep the idea of banks, which then translates into visual space and that you own money and you have some money saved and you can do this and that with your money from the bank, you think that you're actively involved in that environment. But it's canceled by the digital, where no one buys, sells, or makes profit or loses. The banks are there as an after image for private identity, and therefore they do not disappear, though they were the flagging profits of the banks. Yes, flagging profits of the banks, but the banks cannot disappear as long as Americans agree that that you are James Martinez and I'm not. Okay? Private identity. And at the larger banks and dealers, it worked. Now, the larger banks and dealers is the guys directly involved in building the digital economy. But the cost was an increase in risk to the financial system as a whole. No, financial system disappeared back in the 70s. Or when you had the National Security Act in 1947. Whenever you start to realize that it's a programmed, controlled environment, because the old environments can't keep up with the new digital environment,
right,
then you don't have the proper management that banks and the financiers are supposed to have control of, the so-called Illuminati. So
right.
The financial system was not at risk, but the American people think in English, think of all the literate concepts they learned in college and high school, and that is their cultural speculation. That's the filter they look at this life at the speed of thought.
Cultural speculation, exactly.
Yeah, and that's a rearview mirror. So she goes. Yeah. So she continues, Ellen Brown. Since then, derivative trades have grown exponentially. No, they never grew. Just that from the American and Western books, accounting books method, if you keep typing and then everybody is making more and more money, you think the money is expanding. But no money is growing. There never was any money once you had the digital landscape. All right? So we understand that the typing is the economy. Oil doesn't back the dollar. Gold doesn't back the dollar. Typing backs the dollar. Okay? All right?
Okay, now I'm waiting.
So
okay, keep going.
So she says, since then, derivative trades have grown exponentially until now they are larger than the entire global economy. The Bank for International Settlements recently reported that total derivatives trades exceeded $1 quadrillion. She says that's $1,000 trillion. How is that figure even possible? Good question. You can't visualize a quadrillion dollars.
Nobody can. Nobody can, right.
Yeah, but you have to realize you don't need to visualize it. So the gross domestic product of all the countries in the world is only about $60 trillion. You know, that's like nothing compared to the one quadrillion. The answer
right.
is that gamblers can bet as much as they want. They can bet money they don't have, and that is where the huge increase in risk comes in. So you see how she's going on defining everything in terms of money and what normally happens. I sell something, give something away to you, and you pay me back. This transaction
right.
where I gain or you gain and I lose. But when everybody's typing, nobody's gaining, no one's losing. So just maybe, there's a lot more in this article, but I'll jump ahead. What did Paulson and, mainly Paulson, but maybe Bush and Bernanke, Bernanke's saying it today, he's testifying in Congress, that the system is too big to let it crash. So American International Insurance, that company, what's it called, American International Group, it's too big, 74 million customers. It's an environment. We can't let an environment disappear. Okay.
Right.
That is the old idea of media ecology that Marshall McLuhan came up, that we have to program the environment. We have to bypass the idea that anybody's in charge and private identity is controlling the situation. These environments are a given factor, and you have to, in the Federal Reserve days, 100 years ago, give money away by income taxing first. Then Roosevelt brought in the New Deal, which made money public property. It's no longer private. And that fact of this environment of electronic and later digital technology creating the law of a new weather and climate you live in is what they mean when they say we can't let it go. But they could let it go. They could let AIG collapse. They could let the Fannie Mae if they understood that typing is what is the economy. But because they're Americans, they think that things have to be balanced in the books. And yet, if you actually look at what's going on when you look at those four guys, there is no Treasury, there is no Federal Reserve, there is no President, there is no Securities Exchange. It's all one image of an environment that humans don't have the imaging ability to relate to. It's like quantum physics. You can't see the Hadron Collider, right?
Mm-hmm.
Remember the Hadron Collider a couple of weeks ago? That was a big event for a day. It was going to blow up the world as they analyzed the particles, right?
Right, exactly.
I didn't keep up on that. The world, some worlds have blown up, but that happened before the Hadron Collider. It's interesting. We can check that. The Hadron Collider event was right in the middle of this explosion on Wall Street last week, right?
Interesting correlation, yes.
Yeah, interesting pattern there. And, of course, from the Hadron Collider point of view, they didn't blow us up, but a blow-up happened somewhere else. So everything is so interfaced. There's no difference other than thinking. And what is thinking? What is thinking? No one's ever figured out what our brains are.
Yeah, nobody knows what consciousness is.
What?
Right. Nobody knows can define consciousness.
Yeah, so we are incredibly involved in not the collective unconscious, the collective consciousness, which is thinking. The problem is if you don't have the way to define it, which I'm attempting to say is valid in my terms, then you are unconscious.
Okay, but now, with that, wait a second now. With these guys doing this bailout and those four guys standing before America and the world,
which they're not doing, they're not bailing out. What?
What's going to happen next?
The same thing that happened 10 years ago. Nothing. Yeah, other than constant typing speculation and watching the dead cat bouncing, and it's a living cat, and it's going up and down, like the market went down yesterday and it went up a little bit this morning and went back down today, it'll keep oscillating. What is dangerous, and that's why this is and should be a press conference, is that people like Ellen Brown and everybody else who's trying to pay attention to the newspapers and the news and what's going on and define what's happening and whether Congress should support this $700 billion bailout, those people will crack. So we've got a problem here where millions of people are going to panic and get hysterical on a lot of different levels. Now, that's actually been going on in your world for 10 years. You've seen it.
Yes, and it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I had a caller calling yesterday that is just, I mean, it's not just that they're losing everything they've ever worked for in their life. They're having massive paradigm shifts of what value is, what their goals are, who they are, why are they even participating in a market or an economy that is going to fail them. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's still there, Bob?
Sorry, just a second. There was some noise nearby. I had to put the mute on. Okay, what you just said is illustrative of the dilemma. They're trying to find out what their private identity is in relation to this blur of speculation, and they're trying to establish who they are. And that is important because they're conditioned by their culture, and we all are. And we need to define what our cultural standards and conditioning is in relation to this new post-information society.
Nobody's done that, and people from all over the country that I speak to in emails, they nobody trusts anymore. Everybody's panicked. They're completely, totally disturbed and disgusted by our misleaders that are not even coming clean with stuff. So it is the panic ratio is higher than I've ever known, actually.
Right. So Chris Story is saying the Congress will declare martial law in October. Okay?
Right.
They're planning it already. Mm-hmm. And this is during the congressional recess for the month of October, preparing for the election. So the panic will lead to government saying, we have something to do. We need to control this situation.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem is that the government is not the government as we think it is. The government is us typing. So we are going to continue to harass ourselves, put ourselves in concentration camps because we continue typing. And
we've turned into a bunch of cutters, self-mutilating almost.
Oh, did you say putters?
Cutters. We self-mutilate.
Yes. Well, that began at the digital environment 30 years ago with the punk movement. Remember, the punks would cut themselves. The young people always expressed what's going on. When we moved into the digital environment in the mid-70s, that's when Saudi Arabia became the main banker for the United States. That's where the U.S. Treasury no longer was the U.S. Treasury, it was the Saudi Treasury, and then the Saudis took over the CIA and all that stuff that led to September 11th. That is an example of us cutting ourselves, and the young kids expressed it in punk. All right?
Yes.
That was the motif. But what are the young kids doing today? What are they expressing today?
Well, I know what they're doing today. They're not even remotely aware because their consciousness is so filtered into this chip environment that they're not even in the universe. They're texting back and forth and on computers constantly. I mean, I see it here. They're not even aware.
Yeah, James, let me say the ideal, and I read a few articles on Main Street and how it reacted to the 7 days that shook Wall Street last week. And a lot of the college kids are planning to work in Wall Street, which means they think I can get into the best typing environment, Wall Street, work for some brokerage or hedge fund, and I'll make trillions. That's where they know the action is. They're not interested in expressing themselves like the punks did or the techno culture of the 80s or the Nirvana, or what, grunge movement. All these movements die once we move into the year around the year 2000 in a post-information society, and knowing that typing is where it's at, these kids practice typing every day on their instant messaging, and they're preparing to get a nice seat in Wall Street where they can continue typing in luxury. The problem is that the chip landscape now is totally visible. It's gone, and we're in a post-chip landscape. So the four guys that stood there are obsolete rearview mirror, and they're hogging our press conference. I'm wrapping up here. We got to end this, but I'll continue this article next week and keep working on this because this is the only issue to be talked about. How to define where we're at.
Okay, now, defining where we're at, let's speculate, if we can, on what's going to happen once they do this martial law, if they even do that. Because you got a bunch of people. So the martial law, I'm guessing, just based upon people that I talk to, is because there's going to be civil unrest. People are really, really, they want to blame somebody. I'm presuming that's what's going to happen. But once they do that, what are they going to quarantine all the typers here?
Yeah, that's why the idea that there would be the old-fashioned martial law is not the right image. Martial law came in with the Patriot Bill, and the new rules after the dot-com crisis on Wall Street that ex-governor of New York Spitzer brought in and became famous, the rules for the surveillance of Wall Street activity in 2002 and up to now. The surveillance is martial law. It's not a chemical body martial law, it's a surveillance. So people are saying if the government buys up everything, the debt, then the government owns our homes and owns everything, and we're nationalized, we're communists, and that means we're being surveilled. That is not what to worry about. We should actually encourage more surveillance because that allows more and more people to be employed to be typing and monitoring the digital camera on you. That'll keep the economy going.
Okay, so if more people are typing, there's more surveillance, that means, what is that going to mean? What's the effect of that going to be with more surveillance? That means more paranoia.
More paranoia, more hysteria, more hysteria, more panic, more ecstasy. You'll take your pick, whichever one you want to express. The point is it won't be measurable unless you understand you've got four bodies. This structure I'm offering is the clue to mental health in this inevitable situation. That's what we're offering here. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, right now, John Stewart, what time is it? I don't know. Maybe they're taping now. I don't know when John Stewart's taping. But all day long, John Stewart's been working up jokes to deal with this stuff, to keep the verbal stuff going so he can keep the White House alive, right? And that's an important part of the ecology. But he is actually, by doing that, implementing martial law. We are implementing martial law by doing this show. All of us are doing it to ourselves. And ourselves are made up of four structures, represented in that press conference, collectively, the U.S. Treasury, the digital landscape, the Federal Reserve, the broadcasting media of the first half of the 20th century, the ancient money supply, George Bush, the oligarchy, and local community. Who are we representing? You represent aid for a local community of people in debt, and they call you. You're some kind of savior for the local sense of I'm an American and I'm in debt. But the people you're dealing with have the other three bodies, represented by those four people who are having a press conference at the White House, which is the only arbiter of fact for those that think there needs to be fact. So we are in a zillion-dollar economy, not quadrillion, zillion, because it can't be measured. Or we are totally bankrupt, and it doesn't matter that we're bankrupt as long as we keep typing. So communication is the key to the present, but the effects of this incredible situation, to the degree we don't have get our press conference heard, will lead to real tension.
Tension, right. Well, what we're going to do, because I know we're out of time here, is I'm going to see how this unfolds. I want your comments from everybody. If you want to email me on what you thought about this broadcast, I want you to listen to this over and over again. You can email me at getdebtreliefnow@gmail.com. We're out of time. Bob, thanks a lot for coming on. I was very interested to see what you had to say about the Fall Street and the whole incident that just took place. Everybody, if you're trying to reach me, you may do so at 888-213-7655, or you may email me. We'll see you again tomorrow, everybody. This is Cashflow with James Martinez for September 24th, 2008. Take care, everybody. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, James.
this is James Martinez from the Cashflow Show. I want to ask you one question and one question only. You're ready to change your life. Now, as you begin to think about that question, how many of you are swimming in credit card debt, tired of your credit cards controlling your life, behind in your payments, struggling to make ends meet, worried about your financial well-being? You're going to end that now. Enough is enough. This is hot. Are you ready to feel good? Now? That's right. Call our 800 number and listen to the 12-minute overview. It explains who we are and what we do to end your credit card debt. Leave your name and number after the message and do it today. Call 888-213-7655. That's 888-213-7655. Freedom is a phone call away. Away. Away for you to feel good now. 888-213-7655. 888-213-7655.
AchieveRadio.com, what talk radio should be all the time.